Veteran Stacy Bear was suffering from PTSD, burdened by suicidal thoughts, and drinking heavily after a second deployment in Iraq. One day, Bear and his brother were arguing while hiking when they suddenly viewed the breathtaking Druid Arch in Utah's Canyonlands National Park. The men's jaws dropped. They laughed. They hugged. Whatever were they arguing about? It was an experience that ultimately led Bear to a lifelong passion, bringing other veteran PTSD sufferers to the outdoors to help them heal. Activist Rebecca Sentner took a rafting trip down the Canning River to the Arctic Ocean, a place she had been working for years to protect. She went with seven others, none of whom she'd met before the trip. They spent 10 days in this Arctic National Wildlife Refuge experiencing discomfort, anxiety, and exhaustion, as well as beauty, amazement, and wonder. Friendships formed as they bonded through unique, sometimes challenging, sometimes awe-inspiring experiences. They had begun the trip as strangers, but returned as friends. Astronaut Shane Kimbrough recalls an overwhelming launch, then the feel of the engines cutting off, then floating to the window to look out. "I'm in space." It hit him. A dream he had had since childhood. In a short film called The Overview Effect, he and other astronauts describe the view. The line that separates day and night slowly moving across the planet, clouds casting long shadows, the earth coming alive with the lights from the cities and towns, thunderstorms like a spectacular fireworks show. It was described as an experience of awe, a transcending of a regular sense of separation at some very deep level, one said. They were realizing their interconnectedness with that beautiful, blooming ball. All these people had been touched, astonished, moved. Their experience of themselves and the moment they were in was indelibly altered by this one elusive emotion, awe. It's a phenomenon, research suggests, that changes our perceptions, puts things into perspective, making us more open, more humble, more connected. Awe can make us more available for new experiences, can make room for new relationships, or spark change in the relationships we already have. Awe even appears to increase people's willingness to help others. In one experiment, psychology professor Dacher Keltner and his colleagues took participants to a spectacular grove of Tasmanian blue gum eucalyptus trees, some with heights exceeding 200 feet. Researchers had participants either look up into the trees or at the facade of a nearby tall science building for 1 minute. Then a minor quote-unquote accident occurred, actually a planned part of the experiment. A person stumbled and dropped a handful of pens. Participants who had spent that minute looking up at the tall trees long enough to be filled with awe were more likely to pick up the pens, were more likely to to help the other person. Awe-inducing events may be one of the fastest and most powerful methods of personal change and growth, Keltner writes. Can open us up to a whole new way of experiencing and engaging with the world. As Einstein is reported to have said, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. But even so, even with all the benefits of opening to awe, I, and maybe you too, so often find myself walking between the miraculously suspended walls of the Red Sea, looking down, complaining about the mud, which is everywhere. And when I do, I miss that miracle. I miss so many miracles. Keltner claims our whole culture is awe-deprived. We are spending more time working and commuting, less time outdoors and with other people, less time on camping trips at picnics or gazing at midnight skies, he writes, more time working weekends and late at night. And for our kids, he says, we tend to prioritize resume building activities and test preparation over unstructured time or time outdoors. And even when we're there, even when we get ourselves outdoors or somewhere beautiful, we sometimes still just miss it. You can look at something vast, like the midnight sky, Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron writes, and the first hit is always, wow, it's huge, and your mind opens. But if you stand there long enough, you'll start to worry about something. We begin to shut down, shut out, she says, as if we were sitting on the edge of Grand Canyon, but had put a bag over our heads. I do this. I notice something breathtaking, and before I know it, I've got some mental commentary going in my head. That's pretty, my mind says to me. Now I'm no longer actually present to the thing. Now I'm judging the thing. The next thought might be, that's pretty, but I've seen other pretty things. Or maybe I'll think about who I should tell about it, how I might describe it, how impressed they'll be or should be that I was there. Or maybe I think about what time it is and when are we supposed to have dinner anyway and what's it going to be and will I like it? Maybe we should stop by the store. I need to pick up some toothpaste anyway. Why do we do this kind of thing? It seems to happen automatically. Worry seeps in, to-do lists seep in, our rational minds take over to set us back on track, a familiar, comfortable track, where we know what's going to happen next. There's a term for this, apparently. It's called hedonic adaptation. We experience a thing, and it's fantastic. We are fully absorbed. Then next time, it's still great, but not quite as awe-inspiring. And then after a while, or after we do it a few more times, it impacts us less and less and less until it barely touches us at all. It seems once we know what to expect, we don't pay attention the way we did before. Our minds are off imagining the next great thing, or off and running to work out how to prevent the next bad thing, or off to whatever it is that tends to occupy our attention. Our minds swoop in, regulating, controlling, evaluating, creating a fog of mental activity that's like putting a bag over our heads while standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon, or standing in front of a beautiful child, or piece of art, or a beloved friend. Our minds strive to meet expectations, maintain consistency, and we miss it. We miss the miracles. Former UUA President Reverend John Burens once said that religious holidays are not just about marking cycles of time, but also about the upsetting of expectations. In fact, I think that upset of expectations may be the most important piece. The story of Hanukkah tells of a holy band of rebels who had just been through a bloody war, whose temple had been ransacked, who had no consecrated oil to sanctify their holiest space, and who could not be at peace until they did. The story of Christmas tells of that famous wandering couple under threat, she about to give birth, the family no place to stay, uncertain, unsettled, out in the colds. The people in each of these stories were off balance, out of sorts, dealing with the unpredictable and unexpected. And yet, as Reverend Buren writes, it is in these stories we find the mark of God. It is in these stories we find awe. Something about the unexpected, maybe even the upsetting, is central. Something about not getting what we think we want may also open up a window, allowing us to be touched, moved. Even as it can feel threatening, as we heard in our first reading, health scares, job loss, surprise declarations of any kind, upset expectations unnerve us. Even good news, promotions, a new pregnancy, a financial windfall, these things too can knock us out of whack as we must now make room for something new. Yet it may be in exactly these places of not knowing, these places where the mind may finally have nothing left to say, that we find the mark of God, where we find that deeper truth, greater wisdom, wider love. Uncertainty and awe, fear and God all seem to be connected. I find it interesting that in the Bible, the word for fear and the word for awe are sometimes interchangeable, and they are both used to apply to this concept of God. There is an iconic awe story in the Bible. It's Moses encountering a burning bush in the desert, a burning bush that catches his attention, piques his curiosity, draws him near. As he approaches, he hears the voice of God. "Take off your shoes," this voice commands, "for you are standing on holy ground." Moses' curiosity turns to a mix of fear and reverence, terror and amazement. He is struck by awe. In this story, though, Moses doesn't get distracted. His mind doesn't appear to pull him away. There's no paper bags anywhere in this story. He stays, listens to the voice. He argues, for sure, but then he listens again. In fact, that burning bush moment is the beginning of one of the most awe-inspiring stories in the Bible, the story of the Exodus. The Israelites escape from bondage through the passage of the Red Sea, the story whose significance our other friends, Reuben and Shimon, completely missed. In an article on awe and fear in the Bible, writer Tara Sophia Moore quotes spiritual teacher Rabbi Alan Liu. He describes Moses' state in that burning bush moment as a unique mixture of awe and fear that we feel in the presence of what we call the divine, whether in the form of a burning bush or in the form of a still, small voice within ourselves. The unexpected can lead to holy ground. Being unsettled can lead to fear and awe, and fear and awe can open us up to a still, small voice that points somewhere. In that same article, Moore describes the feeling we get when we listen, really listen to that small voice inside, when we become willing to act on it. In that moment, there's fear, and there's awe, and there's energy, and there's the feeling of inhabiting a larger space than we're used to inhabiting. It's the kind of thing that shows up in those moments when we uncover a dream, access our real feelings about an important situation, or contemplate taking a big leap toward a more authentic life. We feel sacred awe, which has a kind of trembling in it. So, awe can grab us in a moment, draw us out of our preoccupations, haul us into the present moment, and wake us up. It can be a window into magnificence, a bigger perspective, and an open-eyed humility all at the same time. Moments of awe can show us what's possible. But we can become separated from experiences of awe by our own very well-intentioned minds, seeking safety in stability, in work, in strong resumes or high test scores, creating a cloud of thinking that stays with us all the time. And so we can become immune to awe, so that it requires something more and more awe-inspiring until we finally wake up. It may even be true that the more we seek awe directly, the more we focus on creating life's highs and avoiding its lows, the more we create that fog, the more our minds cut us off, the more elusive awe actually can become. But maybe awe was never meant to be an end in and of itself in the first place. Maybe awe was always meant to be a window or a door. A window through that mental fog that shows us who we really are and how we fit. A door that opens to a way forward. A door to holy ground, where we can finally hear some still small voice telling us where our hearts most want to go. A path based in connection, humility, and purpose. A path to playing our part in a larger, awe-inspiring whole of which we just got a glimpse. It may not be the easy way, necessarily. Just ask Moses, or that faithful Christmas couple, or veteran Stacey Bear, activist Rebecca Centner, any astronaut or anyone who's ever tried to do something deeply meaningful. But it's a gratifying path, and it may just open the way to more awe still. In this month of miraculous light and miracle births, may we be open to the unexpected, to beauty, to trembling, to the insights of a greater truth and love, which is sometimes hidden, but always there. May we be willing to walk through the mud and muck of the unexpected and unsettling, knowing that these may just be preparing us to finally see. May we live our lives opening to the miracles around us everywhere. Amen. Let us join together for our closing hymn, number 1064, in your smaller hymnal. Please rise in body or in spirit. Amen.